Welcome to Oklahoma Voices. I'm Susan Shannon. Native American cultures are getting a helping hand from a surprising source: tourism. The stereotypes of insensitive non-Indians picking through baskets and turquoise jewelry while still alive and well is not what the American public or the world looks for in a vacation. They want an experience, and often is not. They want to learn. In 1991, under the Highway Bill, a position was created at the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. for a transportation specialist and tourism coordinator. Edward Hall III filled that position. He is a member of the Arikaraa and Hidatsa Nations from North Dakota. He is also a co-founder of the American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association, or IANTA.
That is correct. My position was created back in 1991 under the Highway Bill, and that essentially recognized our nation's transportation system as being a critical part of our economic development. That was during NAFTA and GATT, and so they also included Indian Country as a major component to the Highway Bill and recognized tourism as one of the major economic drivers for our country. So all of that just kind of came into being, and this position was created really to take the new programs that had been created under the Highway Bill at Federal Highways, including the opportunities for Indian Country to be part of all of those programs, and to see how we could start providing tribes with the technical resources to be a part of not only their own internal planning and development of their infrastructure, but also part of the larger discussion on how they can be part of our nation's economy and part of the global economy.
I know myself, before I started becoming in touch with IANTA, which I discovered just a couple weeks ago through the Native News Network, I don't think people would put such importance on tourism, but for Native Americans, it's going to be terribly important.
Personally, I believe it's one of the most important opportunities that we have in Indian Country. It's not just about economic development. You know, one of the most critical things that we found is that there is a tremendous audience out there of people who want to learn about our stories. And tourism is the avenue for us to educate the world. You know, the most important thing that we have to offer is ourselves, our culture, our communities. And the reality is that people come here and they want to know on that landscape what that story is about the first people who were here. And largely that story isn't available. And so through IANTA, we're able to now start connecting back our stories, our history with that, fill in the whole gaps within the American story, but also give us a relevance and a context to where we are today. And I think that's really important, not just for an industry, but it's really important for our youth. You know, I think that tourism is an industry that also has a kind of a bad spin, you know, the tourist, the ugly tourist, whatever. But in reality, you know, it's an industry of diplomacy for us. It's an industry that offers us an opportunity to build businesses, to build our infrastructure, and create an environment where our communities have the ability to maintain sustainability inside. We don't have to send our children outside to go into a profession or whatever. We need to start looking at how we build our jobs, how we build our infrastructure at home. So, you know, it is a thriving place, and everybody has that future.
Now, the conference for IANTA, what is its basic role?
Well, you know, this is our annual conference, and honestly, you know, as I said, the Highway Bill mandated, really, too, that we provide technical assistance and training in recreational travel and tourism. And so this is a kind of an ongoing project that came out of the 1995 White House Conference on Tourism during the Clinton administration, and we looked at this as an opportunity to start a foothold in providing technical assistance and training. But now it's grown into, you know, the evolution of an organization called IANTA, because we also recognize that this is a big, huge industry, and it's a complex industry. And so we needed to start developing the professional status of Indian Country for this industry. So, American Indian tourism professionals? You know, how do we start looking at that? How do we get the engagement of Indian country with this industry and empower ourselves to control our own industry? That's been a major part of it. So this conference then is kind of our annual time to showcase what we've accomplished in the prior year, bring to the forefront our partners. You see partners here like Kevin Gover this morning. You'll see the Southeast Tourism Society. You'll see the Brand USA, Tout Tours. All of these people are here to interface with Indian country. You know, they also want to support what we do, and they want to support and see us as a very important part of what they do. You know, so this is a very busy time, this conference, because it's not only the technical assistance and training, it's the networking and interface with industry. And it's also about bringing some incredible resources to the table. So, you know, we look at the intellectual and cultural property training that we have here. You know, Kilpatrick Stockton and NARF, the Native American Rights Fund, have helped us to develop this particular training for tribes, because we don't want this to be an industry that exploits us either. We want us to go in with our eyes wide open, you know, so that we understand that we as a community have to make our own protocols and make our own decisions on what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, and how we protect our intellectual and cultural property in the exchange, because people are coming here to learn about that. And we all know from bad experience how that can go wrong. So that's a part of it. We also are working with the Tribal GIS Support Center and George Washington University to help work to develop inventory processes and strategic planning processes for tribes entering into the tourism industry. So we have a number of partners here that have expertise that are really vital, I think, to tribal communities, so that you're not just looking at tourism from a standpoint of an event or, you know, trying to put a cultural center together. It's the whole picture of how this can be a sustainable part of your economy.
And just one last thing. You've got some very interesting partnerships, like with the National Park Service. Could you kind of tell us a little bit about that? And it isn't like a natural fit.
Well, you know, the other part of this whole thing is the partnerships is critical, but elevating IANTA in, I guess, not just the federal government, but in the industry, has been critical. And we were able to sign an MOU with the Secretary of Interior 2 years ago. And from that, then, we were able to engage with the federal agencies, but the National Park Service has stepped forward, you know, really to kind of be the leader in this whole thing, in introducing and to engaging the public lands, the federal agencies, to bring our tribal stories to the forefront, to bring authenticity into the presentation. And so one of the things that we did even prior to all of this and has been kind of the template was the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial event, and that was incorporating tribes into a national event. And through that, we created the Circle of Tribal Advisors to the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. And from that, then, the Bicentennial Council chose to make the American Indian side of the story their number one priority, which is a huge, huge change. So now we have a National Park Service coming forward inviting IANTA to be part of the 150-year anniversary of the Civil War. And one thing you'll see here as a product of that is we were able to, in just general discussions with them, talk about the idea of doing a book on American Indians and the Civil War. And they thought, well, that's a novel idea. We'll think about it. We agreed to do it. And in the process of doing it, we found out how much information is out there and how much information we couldn't even put in the book. It's the tip of the iceberg. And we started recognizing the context of history with place. And so the national parks are then working with us to introduce the tribal authentic stories to the national parks. And I think that's going to be a tremendous change in terms of how that's been presented in the past, in terms of having the national parks tell our stories for us or tell a piece of history but not the whole story. And in many parks, it's not just one tribe. It's many tribes that have a relationship with that area. So we've been a country so caught up in one theme, and then we're done. We need to be looking at the layers of history here and being able to open up the door of many tribes to tell their stories. The congressman this morning that spoke, I mean, he really did nail it. You know, it's about our communities really taking back an ownership of our culture and being proud once again and where we come from and who we are. And through tourism, this industry is showing our youth that there are people out there that really do appreciate our culture and our story. And so it's a reversal of kind of where we had been going historically. And it's also causing people in the other communities around us to see when we have an audience coming in, like these international folks who have a deep appreciation and respect for us, that that's a whole different kind of exchange, and that we're actually bringing something of value that has been here for all these years and has not been recognized.
The Congressman Hall spoke of was Mark Wayne Mullen, a member of the Cherokee Nation. The other speaker he talked about was Kevin Gover, director of the National Museum of the American Indian. Gover, a member of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma, eloquently spoke about what tourism, along with museums like the NMAI, could do for Indian country, the education factor, but not just about Indians and their cultures, about Indians today and who is an Indian. During the conference came the news that Cherokee Nation citizen Dustin Brown would have to return his daughter Veronica to her adoptive parents, and that news was not welcome news. Gover mentioned that during his address.
My point is that we all get taught things about Indians, and non-Indians in particular get a very limited amount of information about Indians from the popular culture and in their formal education, and much of what they learn is wrong. And yet they bring those attitudes to issues like Dustin Brown's case, and based on what they know, it all makes sense. It never occurs to them that the things they know are wrong or incomplete. And so that's a problem for us, and it really does affect tribal rights, and it affects the public's view of issues involving tribal sovereignty.
Now, we're having trouble here in Oklahoma getting the American Indian Cultural Center funded. And a lot of people say, why have another museum about Indians? How would you answer them?
Well, I think there's always a need for more public education, more opportunities for people to learn what they want to know about Indians. And we know from the success of our museums in Washington and New York that there is a strong public appetite for more information about Indians. And so we should be trying to seize every opportunity to engage these folks who are volunteering to come and learn about us and to give them good information.
Was it a natural jump for you to be the head of a museum after being kind of a lawyer person in government?
Well, no, it wasn't a natural jump. I'm surprised. I still am surprised that I'm the director of a museum. But a lot of the skills that I acquired, a lot of the knowledge that I acquired from practicing law, from being a government executive over the years, and from being a law professor really do come into play and are useful to me in being director of the museum.
Attendees of the conference were given the opportunity to visit the Cherokee Nation Complex in Tahlequah and the Chickasaw Nation Cultural Center in Sulphur. Among the many workshops offered was one on how to work with the Smithsonian. Cherokee Nation citizen and OU graduate Carolyn McClellan was a presenter. McClellan is the Assistant Director for Community and Constituent Services for NMAI. Her duties are many, but she concedes she has a lot of help.
We oversee all of our cultural programming that we do at the museum, including our live concerts, festivals, seminars and symposia, internships, fellowships, and implementation of our National Education Initiative and community outreach.
McClellan explained that her workshop was not just about how to work with the Smithsonian, but how to make the experience their own unique tribal experience.
It's that, but it's even better defined as how can tribes make it more of their museum, and so how can they host events at the museum to show that they have vibrant cultures, vibrant economies, that they haven't faded away, that Native Americans still exist in the U.S. and elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere, and how can they showcase their cultural heritage at our museum.
McClellan's fellow presenter and colleague, Sean Terman, from the Ogallala Lakota Nation, is the Cultural Arts Manager for NMAI in D.C. and New York City.
I get to follow up on what Carolyn mentioned. Basically, I work directly with Native artists, performers, demonstrators, dance groups, theater, people doing contemporary art. We have a big art market, and we really teach our public that Native people have a rich history of cultural traditions through baskets, through pottery, through songs, through dance, and that we're still here. The traditions are alive, and we present them at the museum, and we also take it into contemporary, that Native people can do everything that contemporary America's doing, and better most of the time, I think.
Now, how do you find your artists and your artisans, and does this cause you to go out into Indian country?
That's a great question. First off, we're here today because we're speaking about how to bring Native Indian country to our museum, but we do, when we first opened, we did a lot of travel. Those days are long gone, and now we receive proposals, we research. When we're out at events like this, we're always trying to meet new artists, and you know, most artists want to be a part of what we do, and a lot of them send us their information, and we try to fit them with the perfect program that would work to highlight them the best. It's always about making our artists the best. You can go to our website. There's information, how to contact the Museum Programs Division, and that's how most of our things are coming through email nowadays with e-bios, e-packages, that kind of thing. So we used to get a lot of mail, but now it's a new world.
The social media is.
Social media is big. And it's really good because in the old days, you really did have to go out and see people. Just even 10 years ago, you didn't have what you have on YouTube. And people can say, oh, catch this video, and here I am performing at different places. And if you go to YouTube, you see a lot of people performing at our museum. And we try to be helpful to them to promote their career also throughout the, you know, North America, Canada, Mexico, everywhere, so they can grow as artists. It's really about us being there as a tool for our performing artists, our demonstrating artists.
You can't have a Native conference without the exhibitor booths, Native peoples who are sharing their work, being their own advertisement. To my surprise, one of Oklahoma's premier artists and teachers, Ruth Blaylock Jones, was at a booth with her daughter Nancy, a clothes designer. Jones is retired after 30 years as director of the art school at Bay Cone College, located near Muskogee. Bay Cone, which was established in 1880, has a long history of educating Native Americans, but is open to all races. Jones is enjoying an active retirement.
I don't paint as much as I had planned to, but I should be painting full time. But I'm approaching that, we'll say.
Now, they're saying that tourism can really be the key to preserving culture, language, traditions. What's your thought on that?
I would think so, because I've done a little traveling, and I'm very impressed. And she just mentioned about the artwork here in this facility. And so I've been very impressed going around the country and seeing particularly the casinos and how they've spent money on their own tribal people and put their own work in the casinos, such as the clothing and different artwork. Besides paintings and sculptures and all. But they've also, several of them have museum quality exhibits of different cultural items, such as rattles and in this part of the country, shells, and in other parts of the country we've seen buckskin dresses and feather headdresses and things like that. So I think for tourism, people that come to those places are seeing the actual, you know, the genuine object. So I think that's very good.
I know they said one thing in there that tourism, the best way to educate could be through tourism.
I think so. I think that's it's a new thing. It hasn't really been done before. Speaking from the Indian standpoint, we've been deluged with poor imitations and copies, and just not even copies, but just distortions. And so So this is quite a turnaround, quite a change. And so people are seeing things that they've never seen before. They're seeing things that probably they didn't expect. And they're seeing that not everyone wears feathers and buckskin.
How are you feeling about the state of Indian art in Oklahoma presently?
It's more prominent, I guess you would say. It's more visual. We see it more than in the last few years, perhaps. I'm thinking of the overall standpoint, but from the individual artists, I'm not sure that there's been that much of a change. It's always been the practice that people don't sell their work here, but they have to go other places to sell it. Or when they are here, a part of their promotion, people will say, just back from Santa Fe, or just back from Phoenix, or just in from New York or something. And so maybe that will change. Maybe people will come here to purchase from the artists.
Jones is also one of five commissioners on the Indian Arts and Crafts Board, whose top priority is the implementation and enforcement of the Indian Arts and Crafts Act of 1990.
The other Oklahoman on the board actually is Harvey Pratt from Oklahoma City, and he happens to be the chairman. Our concern is truth in advertising, and as you know, we're concerned with seeing that the Indian Arts and Crafts Law is upheld and supported, and that is that art is produced by Indian people, people who are federally recognized and enrolled members of tribes.
How do you go about putting that into play? I mean, it seems like that would be a really big job.
It's a huge job, and we have very little money, but we have, as you see the exhibit here, we have brochures, and so we try to be visible at events like this with exhibits and handouts and so on, and then we do occasionally also at these events provide speakers and so on. We work with the Parks Service and some other groups. Then, of course, we don't have a enforcement arm, but we do work with the legal agencies to try to enforce the laws.
Isn't there heavy fines?
Yes. It's up to $1 million a day for fraudulent, you know, advertising, for things when you say it's Indian made and it isn't.
Among the many offerings at the exhibitors' booths, most surprising was the work of native cartoonist Ricardo Cate from the Santo Domingo Pueblo in New Mexico.
I'm a cartoonist. I do the cartoon Without Reservations, which is featured in the Santa Fe New Mexican.
What brings you to a tourism conference? How do you fit in?
I don't.
You don't?
No, just kidding. I was invited by IANTA, and they're based in Albuquerque at the Pueblo Culture Center. And my book is on display there at the gift shop, and so are some of my paintings. And one day when I was there, they invited me upstairs, and they told me about this conference. And I told them I could contribute by, I do speaking engagements because of my cartoons, what I do. And so I also do tell a bunch of humorous stories. And so they were happy to invite me, and so here I am, you know, just... I'm also one of the exhibitors here, so I have some of my cartoons and my books here. So,
now your cartoons, they kind of deal with the irony of native life in America. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, it's a lot of people call it the far side. It's like the far side, native far side, and so that's a huge compliment because I was always a Gary Larson fan, Jim Davis, Bill Walker. But there was never any native artists, native cartoonists to look up to, and so I decided just to become one. And at first I was very apprehensive about it, hence the name Without Reservations, because I had some reservations about it. And so so that's how the name came about for the cartoon. But yeah, that's what I draw, about normal native life. And I like to think that this is a universal cartoon, that, and the characters just happen to be native. When I first started drawing, they were native cartoons, and most of the jokes were inside jokes for natives. But then I thought, you know, why can't everybody enjoy them? And so now they have more of a universal theme so that everybody gets it. And that's what I think has made it so popular.
Do you ever get negative feedback, and how do you deal with that?
Oh, at first it was awful. There was like at least 50 letters a week when my cartoon first came out. They were appalled. They said I was racist, that the cartoons weren't funny at all. And then I started answering every single one of those emails and letters that my editor gave me. And it was just a standard general letter where basically I introduced myself as Ricardo Cate. I'm Native American and blah, blah, blah. And then they would write back, oh, you're Native. Well, I guess then it's okay then. And something about me being Native, drawing these Native cartoons made it okay. And so every once in a great while now, maybe one a month I'll get a letter or a complaint. But that person also doesn't know that I'm Native, but once they find out that I'm Native, then I guess it's okay.
Like, black people can use the N-word, but
white
people can.
Yeah, yeah.
What about your background? Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the reservation until I was 14, and then I was sent off to a boarding dormitory up in Ignacio, Colorado, on the Southern Ute Reservation. But the dorm kids there, half were Navajo, the other half were Southern Ute, Northern Ute, and then some Apache, and then five of us were Pueblo Indians. We were bused to a nearby school, which was a public school, and that was my first introduction to talking to non-natives. So even though we live right between Albuquerque and Santa Fe, we always went to town, but every time we went, you know, my dad did all the talking. He would order the food. He would buy the tickets for the movies. We never really mingled with any of the non-natives, you know. We just talked amongst ourselves. And so when he dropped me off in Ignacio, I was basically forced to confront them. And so it was, it's been funny ever since, you know. Just, I don't know, It's been a cool trip.
That was Ricardo Cate, Native cartoonist, featured in the Santa Fe New Mexican newspaper and various tribal newspapers. I hope you've enjoyed these excerpts from interviews taken at the American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association's 2013 conference held at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tulsa last September. The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the management of KGOU or the University of Oklahoma. For more information or to hear this broadcast again, go to our website, kgou.org. For Oklahoma Voices, I'm Susan Shannon.